Sometimes women may not know they're experiencing a heart attack because they only have heard of the so-called standard symptoms, in other words, the symptoms for men. Dosages for some medicines were determined based on clinical trials that included men only. Infant mortality rates are roughly 3 times higher for African Americans than that of the national average. These are just a few examples of types of inequities in women's health. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. Joining me today to explore inequities in women's health both at home and abroad are two OBGYN physicians from the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, Dr. Gloria Sarto and Dr. Cynthia Anderson. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to start with you, Gloria, because you're a professor emeritus of medicine, so you've kind of been in the pioneering state of the Department of Medicine in terms of roles for women doctors and attitudes about women's health. Can you say something about why you've spent your professional career really working around the topic of women's health and inequities with women's health?
Well, it really started when I was an intern at Cleveland Metropolitan General Hospital, where I took care of primarily minority women. And it was apparent to me, having come from Madison, Wisconsin, to go into something like that, that I realized that there was really disparities in the health outcomes among minority women. So that got me started. And then I came back and had a residency program here. And then when I continued to have an interest in it, when I went to the University of New Mexico, the interest grew primarily because I could see the inequities there among the populations that were there. And so I decided that, you know, I just continued to have that interest. When I returned to Wisconsin, I worked with Gloria Johnson Powell, who was involved with disparities and inequities in healthcare. And so I continued to do that, and that's why I kept going.
What about you, Cynthia? What drew you to this sort of, first of all, to the OBGYN field and also to the idea of working on inequities in women's health?
Well, I guess when it comes to OBGYN in general, I've just always loved caring for women. Being able to be there at really some of the most intimate and dramatic moments of women's lives, and usually women are surrounded by family when those moments are happening. So it's really such a privilege. And some of those moments are really joyful and some are really tragic and devastating. And it's always a privilege to be there to help women and families move through those experiences. So that's kind of what drew me to OBGYN. And when it comes to disparities in care, I think my passion for that really began while I was a Peace Corps volunteer living in Kenya. I started to understand how little women really understood about their own bodies, their own anatomy, their own fertility, and experienced the loss of a child in the village where we were living due to protein malnutrition. And it really was because the mother didn't have the information about nutrition and the benefits of breastfeeding to really understand what she could have done to have prevented that. And it really struck me that the inequalities in access to information and access to care was directly responsible for the loss of that life. And so I just knew that I wanted to go to medical school after that and continue to work on closing the gaps in, you know, access to information and access to health care for women.
Mm. And is it true, Gloria, that you had to start Lamaze classes in the basement against the opposition from men who thought that women did not need help during labor?
Well, that's correct.
That sounds like something you would do.
And because I was a nurse before I went into medicine, so I realized how much nursing helped in labor. And so when there were two women that were trying to get the Lamaze started, they needed someone to talk to, and so what we did do, we just met down in the basement of the then clinical hospital and set up the program. And so we finally got it going, and so that we could have people in labor, and then also eventually people in the delivery room. And so that's correct. That's how that started.
With some opposition.
Yes, there was opposition by OBGYN people because they thought, oh my goodness, you know, what's going to happen here? Who's going to take care of these patients? And so they really were concerned about it, yes.
Well, let's look a little bit historically back at the problem of women's health because, I mean, one thing you could say is that it's better now than it used to be for women, maybe not where we need it to be, but it used to be worse. Can you elaborate on that? What if you look back at the sort of the history of women's health in this country in particular, what do you see as some of the really glaring disparities and bad examples of how women were treated in medicine?
Well, I think that we've come a long way. I think there was obviously, I remember one of my first patients was a graduate student, and it was when I was a resident, and I walked in the room, and she said she didn't want to have a woman doctor because it, you know, it was thought that women weren't as good as men.
You weren't the real thing.
That wasn't, and so, that's correct, and so, but she stayed, and then I delivered one of her kids and then the second one, so we got to be quite good friends. But it was interesting and different for me because I'd been accepted. I was the only woman in the residency program at the time, but I was so accepted by everybody that I never thought about that. But it was an issue, yes. But it's changed, and the health of women has changed a lot. And I think we have so much more to work with now than we did have. And when you think that at the turn of this century, 19th to the 20th century, the lifespan for women was about 46 or 47 years. And by the end, it was 78 years. So a lot transpired over that time. And so I think it's really one of the more interesting times for women's health was the 20th century.
What about the whole attitudes toward contraception for women over the past century?
Yeah, it wasn't really until the 1970s when contraception became widely available. And at that time, it was really the pill was the big splash. And since that time, we've accumulated a lot more information about the benefits of family planning and timing and planning for pregnancies. And, you know, there's really pretty good evidence now to show that women who experience unintended or unplanned pregnancies have a higher likelihood of dropping out of school, of not achieving their own educational goals, of not being able to achieve their own financial independence and achieving the same, you know, level of professional attainment that they might have achieved otherwise. And there's a lot of, you know, social impact on women who experience unintended pregnancies as well. In terms of relationship stability and relationship satisfaction and economic stability. So there's been a lot of research that's gone into family planning and contraceptive access. And I think we're really at this amazing time in history where we're starting to understand that long-acting contraceptive devices like IUDs and implants are 20 times more effective than the older methods like pills and such. And really now most of the professional associations like the American College of OBGYN, even the American Academy of Pediatrics, have come out saying that these newer long-acting methods are really the first-line choice of contraception for women who want them. And in places around the country where big studies have been done, like in Colorado and in St. Louis, they found really significant declines in unintended teen pregnancies and really big declines in teen abortion rates, too. So I think we're at this really nice time in history when it comes to contraception. And the Affordable Care Act has also made contraception more widely available to more women without copay. We're not there yet. We have a lot to do in terms of educating healthcare providers about these new methods and training providers to offer them and be skilled in placing them for women who want them, and a lot of public education to do, too, to make women more aware of all the different options that are now available. But, you know, we're getting closer.
And there's more openness about talking about it. And if you look way back, weren't there the sort of Comstock rules where you couldn't mail things through information about birth control through the mail? things like that?
No, that was with Margaret Sanger, who did the original work on trying to get contraception, because it was obvious to her that men could use condoms to protect, prevent infections, but women couldn't. And so she worked on that for quite a while, and even she and her person that worked with her were imprisoned for a while for having talked about the Comstock rules, which were really set up really early, and they kept on with them. But eventually they were ruled, you know, not valid any longer. And it's interesting, though, and Cynthia probably remembers some of this, that really during the time when we were even first starting with giving women contraception, I mean, there are cases where OBGYN people were sued, and finally that we finally were able, going through the lawsuits, to get it so women could be have just the same thing with Roe v. Wade, which was the issue with abortion, so...
Isn't it also an issue that has sometimes come up with insurance companies where they might cover the cost of a vasectomy, for example, but not cover the cost of contraception or tube tying for women or something? Haven't there been inequities in some of the insurance companies?
Yeah, definitely. Historically, there have been a lot of inequities in the way that contraceptive services were made available or the cost of them. In some places today, even now, contraceptives are not made available, for instance, by religiously affiliated organizations. And so there continue to be barriers to accessing the services. But, you know, the Affordable Care Act has made strides toward making it more available to more women with more uniform rules about what can be charged in terms of copay.
Some of the news stories that I've seen recently had to do with discoveries that the wrong dose of a certain medicine had been prescribed for women based on clinical trials that had been done using only men when the bodies responded differently. Can you comment about that?
Yes. When you think about it, the Food and Drug Administration really was enacted. It was the first really administrative, federally administered program. Was still finally in about 1993, they included women in clinical trials because it wasn't. The biggest thing was I was working with a group at the time trying to get have them look at sex and gender differences in health and trying to get the NIH to do research and include women in clinical studies. And we finally, Florence Hasseltine was at the NIH at the time, and we finally got a little group together, and we went to the Congressional Caucus on Women's Issues, and they then decided that the Congress would do a study and look at whether or not women were being included in clinical trials, and it was evident that they weren't. And it was really the aspirin study that was supposed to prevent myocardial infarctions, but that study was done on 22,000 men and not any women.
Isn't that kind of odd that you do a study on 22,000 men? I mean, without kind of, just it seems.
Today, that seems like a very reasonable question. I think back at that time, it wasn't really considered that women should be included.
Well, they were worried, I think, in part because they're worried about pregnancy and if they're on this drug. And that was
right.
Some of the reasoning for not doing it until finally we knew that when that report came out that studies weren't being done, that if it hit the newspapers, it would change, and that really forced the NIH to change. And
difference did it, like if you look at all the different kinds of medicines that get tested and then different recommendations about those medicines get made, whether it's for heart things or other types of medicines, what difference might it make if no women were included? Like how are the bodies different in ways that matter with medication?
Well, I think we're just finding that out, as a matter of fact, as we're doing studies, women, including women in the clinical trials, They, originally what happened is they figure out what the dose was in men, and it'd be so many milligrams per kilogram. And so that's what they adapted to the women, so many milligrams per
kilogram. So just straight kilogram. By weight.
Yeah, by weight. And even there wasn't any pediatric kids studies, and they were almost using the same thing on children. But even now, when they looking at treatment of diabetes and finding that women respond differently to insulin as compared to men. And this now we're finding out, and only because now women are being included in clinical trials.
Would that be because women's hormones are different and the hormones interact with various medications and other treatments? Is that...
Yeah, I think they are looking at the hormone issue with the insulin, and but this now has to be worked on and to see if there are differences depending upon which hormones women have at the time. And so, but I think at least now, and it's really getting more popular to do these clinical trials in women. But then, we're looking at aging women. Well, if they wait too long to do the studies, they have other comorbidities, so it's not being tested on different age women. And so all of that will have to be worked on, I think.
What kinds of, another place where I've heard it in the news is that a lot of women are suffering heart attacks because they don't recognize the symptoms, that the stereotypical patient experiencing a heart attack who has the chest pain, that may not be how a woman would experience it. Is that...
Yeah, you know? Exactly. So the textbook teaching of the symptoms of a heart attack are really the symptoms that would be experienced by a man. And I think now in medical schools, they're teaching more about the variation in presentations and the different clinical signs and symptoms that women might have compared to men. And the symptoms are trickier in women. They're not as obvious. They may be much more subtle. It may not be that sudden crushing substernal chest pain that radiates to your left arm or jaw, which is the classic description for a man. The symptoms may be more variable and more subtle. And so I think as medical schools catch up with that emerging evidence, I think we'll be better at being able to get the word out to women about what they might experience.
It seems surprising that that would take until now. wouldn't it be kind of obvious over the years that it was different? I mean,
well,
I guess I'm having trouble.
Not when textbooks are, being written by men about men and distributed to medical schools. It takes time for these things to change.
But it's not a trivial issue.
In other words,
if you have someone trained a certain way, it affects... First of all, the patient who doesn't recognize her own symptoms, but also if you go into the ER, those symptoms could be taken less seriously then.
That's right.
It's actually
life-threatening.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah, it is.
Are there other areas besides the sort of heart attack case where you have seen the danger of women's health sort of not being necessarily treated as a separate entity with its own...
Well, there are some disorders that are more common in women than men, and I think why that is the case ought to be looked at, but it's not being looked at really. When you think it wasn't until early 1993, I think it was, when we had women in clinical trials, and so we have that yet to learn and test, and so I think that we don't have a lot of examples really. But I think that Cynthia just really answered it when it comes to cardiovascular, and now we're finding that out with insulin, and everyone gets the same dose depending upon what their hemoglobin A1C is or something, mm-hmm. and it might be different, but I think now we're finding out more of that. That's a good question.
Well, we're going to look right here in Wisconsin at some of the surprising inequities when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Drs. Gloria Sarto and Cynthia Anderson. We are talking about inequities in women's health. We were talking in general about some of the problems that happen if women are excluded from clinical trials, you know, not where the specifics of their own bodies maybe aren't widely studied and known about. I was interested in a lecture that you gave some months ago, Gloria, for the Emeritus series that I do, when you spoke about Wisconsin and some of the racial inequities that are affecting women's health here. Can you give some background on that? What is it that's going on right here in our own state?
Well, I think we have the report that came out about disparities. It was pretty obvious. We have quite a few disparities in Wisconsin, and aside from the maternal and infant mortality, which is our black infant mortality rate, as you mentioned, was one of the highest in the country in 1998 when I returned to Wisconsin. I was appalled to see that because I never would have thought about it.
Does that refer, let me just ask for clarification, when you talk about the maternal and infant mortality rate, are you talking about the maternal mortality rate during childbirth in particular then, the mothers who die giving birth and the infants that are dying during childbirth?
Yes, that's correct.
And that's one of the worst in the country?
No, but the infant mortality was one of the worst. But overall, when you look at African-American women, the mortality, maternal mortality and the infant mortality, it exceeds every other. It's higher than, obviously, Caucasian women, non-Hispanic white women, Hispanic women, and so it is among the highest. And just recently, there was something written about the maternal mortality across the nation. And when you look at among developed countries, our country is among the worst. And so I think that it's pretty obvious that we have to do it's got a lot of work to do on that.
What are some of the reasons that you can think of for why would that be? First of all, why would the mortality rate for mothers be higher in this country than some other supposedly less developed countries? And why extra high among African-American women?
Well, there's a lot of things that are being looked at to try to figure that out. One of the things we always want to know is about access to quality health care. So we do know that African-American women and families are more likely to struggle with coverage for medical expenses and coverage for accessing care. And even with coverage, maybe less likely to utilize the services, maybe more likely to present late. So for instance, when it comes to problems like breast cancer, they may be delayed in accessing screening and prevention and more likely to present with later onset disease. So the medical system itself is looking to see what can we be doing differently to promote access to services. But then once the services are utilized, how can we make sure they're of the highest possible quality? And then beyond access to services, there's other social and economic barriers that prevent women and families from getting the care that they need. So when you have less sort of health literacy, it's more difficult to frame the health problems that you have and bring them up in a way that they can be addressed, which also can lead to delay or minimization of symptoms. So people may be less likely to come in and get care. And then the economic barriers that people face in the community. So we talk about the social determinants of health. So those are all sorts of things that can lead to adverse health outcomes that aren't necessarily directly related to medical services, but things like access to quality education, access to a safe and clean water supply, access to a healthy living environment where you can eat fresh foods and exercise in a safe environment. So all of those other social determinants have a really strong impact on people's health, and it's just less likely that African-American families have access to all of those things.
I wonder if some of the studies have been done looking at those rates and removing the income. In other words, if you take poverty out of the equation, whether you still have the same inequity or whether a lot of it has to do with our inequities just economically.
That's a really interesting question. There's a theory about the Life Course Initiative, and they looked at African American women and specifically looked at their birth outcomes. And they looked at women who were, you know, economically successful, educationally achieved, versus African American women who were not quite so much. And they found that the disparities persisted regardless of income status, regardless of educational attainment. There was something about being an African American woman that just put you at risk for these adverse birth outcomes. And so there's some theories about why that may be, and it may be chronic stress, which leads to elevated, you know, inflammatory markers and abnormal hormone levels, induced by things that are in the environment, like, you know, being discriminated mm-hmm. against in a systematic way. So there's a lot of research trying to understand, but it's not specifically restricted to the issue of poverty. It's a bigger issue than that.
I was just thinking, too, that, you know, there's a higher incidence of diabetes in the African-American community. And if, in fact, the insulin rates have been not prescribed correctly because they've not been adjusted to for women, if you had a lot of women with gestational diabetes, for example, who weren't being treated properly, that maybe has a role. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I think in that study that you're talking about, Cynthia, that they did look at a discrimination. If the women felt they were discriminated against as they were growing up, they did have a higher risk. And I think there are so many, when she talked about social determinants, there are so many that we have to look at. And it's going to take a long time.
Absolutely.
To take care of it. And it's really something that everyone's got to be thinking. Policies have to be changed. How people get health care, whether or not we have a food desert. All of this has to be looked at and changed in order to change this.
Well, as you know, I do this program called the Odyssey Project, which is a free college program for adults at the poverty level, about 90-95% African American. And we have a partnership now with the medical school so that my students talk about their health care experiences to new doctors, to medical students.
That's wonderful.
And we called it Prescription for Change, but all of them talked about feeling as if when they went to the doctor, they often had their symptoms discounted or were treated in ways that were in some way discriminatory, that they didn't get the same kind of care that they would have if they had been, you know, a white man in a suit. And it would be hard to kind of break down the whole process from start to finish to figure out where things went wrong. But it is a sort of appalling statistic, isn't it, right here in Wisconsin, if we have that kind of inequity in terms of, you know, mothers dying and babies dying at a higher rate. What are some of the things that you would like to see changed to make that less likely to occur?
Well, one of the things I think we could do within the healthcare system is just create a more welcoming environment. So I think when you're a person of color in the community and you walk into a medical clinic and no one there looks like you or sounds like you, and the things that you say may be misunderstood just because of misunderstanding, that all leads to a poor experience of care, and then people are less likely to utilize the services. And so I think one thing we need to be doing within the healthcare community is looking at how do we create a more welcoming environment where people feel like they want to be there to get the care that they can access. And I think there needs to be a lot more training of physicians, and that's something that my department has been looking at as well as other places within the medical school, the idea of being more culturally aware. I think, you know, trying to be culturally competent is really hard because it's difficult to be competent in a culture that's not your own. But being culturally aware and understanding your own biases and bringing those from an unconscious level of bias to a more conscious level of bias where you can try to do something about it, we need to be doing more of that in medical education.
What about you? What would you like to see change? If you could wave that magic wand, I assume everyone would have high-quality health care.
Yes, everyone would have high-quality health care. And I was just they have culturally and linguistically appropriate standards of care that nationally they have put out there. And I think that helps if we had everyone taking care of people looking at that.
Give me an example. Like, what would be a specific way that that might show up?
If you're Hispanic, you don't speak English. And when I was in New Mexico, that was common. We had a lot of women that came to New Mexico when they had cancer, even though when we took care of them. And so I think that we did the best we could, but everyone in the department was not bilingual. Mm-hmm. And it makes a difference.
Sure.
I mean, and I think as soon as you say a few, and I'm not very good at it, but as soon as you say a few words in Spanish, you know, mm-hmm. You can see they change because it looks like you have an interest. And also then what we're doing is providing a literature. There's a big movement now to look at how things are conveyed. And I think that that also has got to change. And I think if we could get that, and as Ascenti said, we have to do that in medicine with our students and everything. But I think we have to look at it across the board. And I think that there's a lot to be done yet. But I would like to see it so, you know, we could all speak the same language, and also what our educational materials are at a level that people can understand. And because, you know, I had one of my scholars one time that did a study looking at how it was really with African American women, or do they look up something on the website about their illness? And yes, they did. But were they able to convey it to the physician? Not as well. And so I think that these are the things that we have to look at and try to remedy.
Also, I assume making sure that the women who are prescribed things have the resources to pay for them, you know, and the transportation to get there to pick up the, you know, just sort of the practical side, too, of following up.
Yeah, there's a lot of barriers to care that are differential depending on, you know, where you live and how much money you make and whether or not you can get off work without losing your hourly wages. And transportation is certainly one. Access to quality childcare is another. Access to safe and reliable public transportation is another. And then all of the other, you know, cultural and linguistic barriers, too.
I know one of my daughters, when she was pregnant and had gestational diabetes and had a federal insurance plan through a government job that her husband had, it still only covered part of the insulin. And she was trying to figure out if she could kind of cut down on that, you know, and by the time you add in, and it also covered, by the way, 2/3 of a breast pump, just to give you an example of the absurdity. But, you know, if you take that example and then you sort of look out in the entire population where everyone has different kinds of, you know, services or entitlements or plans, and trying to navigate all that, I think it's overwhelming at times just to figure out even what is covered.
As a physician, it becomes really exasperating trying to figure out which plan and which level of that plan and which tier of medication, because you want to pick a medication that's, of course, indicated and useful, but is also going to be covered well by the person's insurance, because if there's too much out-of-pocket expense, they simply won't be mm-hmm. able to afford it or take it at all. So you want to pick something, but you can't possibly know all of the different plans and tiers of plans. And so at some point, you know, one of the things that we do is we get our patient resource representatives involved almost all the time, because everybody's plan is different and you never know what's covered and what's not or how much of it is covered. And so the patient resource representatives can really help navigate some of that payer issue. And then, you know, some patients also have a lot of barriers to surgical services and can't afford to pay the hospital costs because, of course, hospital costs are quite a bit more than clinic costs. So helping people navigate all the different types of services that are available, community care programs and charity services, to try to figure out what they can afford, it gets really tiring.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the other sort of underserved populations besides African-American women giving birth, where the mortality rates are higher? But are there other inequities that you see among this large group of women where some women get better care than others?
Well, when I was, and I think true, our Native population have a hard time getting care. And they have issues. I mean, they have the education issues, and they certainly have health care issues. And in New Mexico, we took care of a large Native population, because in Albuquerque it was 10% Native population, and they used to have their own hospitals, but that didn't exist any longer there. And but we did have clinics closer to where they could get to them, rather than all coming into Albuquerque for their care. And it's interesting that they might be urban to a certain time, but when they were ill, they go back to the reservation, and having physicians to take care of there was, it's hard because it's a big area to cover. And so I think that population we have to think about as well. And I think there are some of our people on our campus that are now looking at the Native population and looking at diabetes and obesity and things like that, mm-hmm. which I think has to happen.
I saw in your write-up as well, Cynthia, that you worked with underserved populations. Mm-hmm. What kinds of areas have you worked in with that?
The clinic where I'm the medical director, we're in the South Madison, sort of South Park Street neighborhood. And I love that neighborhood because it's got one of the most, you know, socially and racially and ethnically diverse populations in Dane County. But there's a lot of people also who have barriers to getting care. And a lot of new immigrant families, some documented and some not. And so there's a lot of linguistic challenges, and I love it. But it is a socioeconomically sort of disadvantaged population generally compared to the rest of Dane County.
And so your passion is to try to get the women who come into the clinic the care they need, whatever those barriers are?
Absolutely, yeah.
We're going to go global when we return in a moment and look at how health inequities for women are being experienced by women all around the globe. Back in a moment with more University of the Year. Gender inequality damages the physical and mental health of millions of girls and women across the globe. That's a statement from the World Health Organization. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Drs. Gloria Sarto and Cynthia Anderson, and we are talking about inequities in women's health. We were talking about sort of general inequities in women's health, and also here in Wisconsin, some of the racial inequities that affect outcomes for women. Let's look more around the world, and just I'm going to start by asking both of you to respond to that WHO statement about the physical and mental health of millions of girls and women around the world. What are some of the glaring areas that led to that statement?
Well, one glaring thing is that there's a very high likelihood that girls will be married at very young ages in a lot of developing parts of the world. So even 12, 13, 14-year-old girls being married at that age, it's really not safe. They're not physically mature. They may be more likely to be malnourished if they have a very early pregnancy event. Their pelvis is not fully formed, and so they're more likely to have pregnancy complications. So certainly early in child marriage is a big problem that needs to be addressed. One of the other things Dr. Sarto has been looking at, and we've discussed also with other members of our department, is the issue of female genital cutting. And the WHO has taken a look at that as well. I don't know, Gloria, if you wanted to comment.
Yes, it's I thought it was quite interesting. There is, as I said, British Broadcasting must have had almost a half hour just looking at that. And also I've reviewed a couple manuscripts for publication. And it's really amazing the number of young women, they die because of complications. And it's something that even though they're working with the villages and they were doing study, one group trying to work with the villages to see if they could cut back on that. And they thought they were having some impact. But then when you look at some of the northern European countries where they have people of cultures that are still doing that, they return to their country or their village or their city where they lived with their daughters. So that they have this female genital mutilation. And it's really, you know, there are over 200 million women that have had it. And the thing is Cynthia says they're younger and younger. And so there really are, some women are trying to get past it with their daughters. But then their mothers, the grandmothers of the daughters, think it ought to be done. So it's really not, it's really going to be difficult, but they're really trying to do something outlawed. There were nurse midwives that were doing it for a while. And then they had a law where nurse midwives could not do it. So then it went to physicians, and some of the physicians are doing it. They haven't outlawed it. And so they take their daughters to physicians and they're and they're continuing to do it. So they're really, I think, globally and massively, and some of these countries are trying to work on cutting, you know, stopping it. And I think that hopefully they will.
And I'm sure it's a sensitive area to work on if it's a major health problem and inequity, but you're coming up against deep-seated traditions.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And how to come in as an outsider, as an outside country, and impose different standards would be tricky. Has there been success at all?
Well, I think you bring up a really good point. I mean, you can't really come in from an outside country and impose your belief system. But I think when the World Health Organization takes the lead and works really closely with the ministries of health in the countries that are seeing the maternal deaths and the child deaths from these problems, then it's really the local ministries of health mm-hmm. that can work with their own healthcare workforce and help work with different tribes and cultures to create campaigns that are going to be locally relevant and culturally appropriate and linguistically appropriate. And so I think, you know, we can help. You know, we can serve as consultants, we can, you know, help on these issues, but I think it really takes close partnership with local healthcare workers and local ministries of health that are taking on these issues.
What are some of the other areas of concern with health besides sort of the infant, you know, the young ages that girls are getting married, the infant mortality rate, the mutilation? What are some other areas of concern if you look around the world, where women disproportionately right. are being affected by inequities in women's health, in health in general?
Right. Well, one of the things, another thing that we've looked a lot at is preventable maternal deaths during childbirth. And, you know, the Millennium Development Goals did a great job of setting targets for individual countries to help work on all sorts of health issues. And many countries were much more successful at reducing rates of newborn and infant deaths and even reducing under 5 child mortality, but have struggled a lot more to reduce the amount of preventable maternal deaths that have happened. And so I think we're at a point now where there's more and more collaboration across countries and including organizations that can really help make a difference. And, you know, some of the leading causes of maternal death are things like hemorrhage and infection, and also unsafe abortion practices. And so when you have a trained healthcare workforce that can provide services, you're going to be much better off. That's one of the things that a lot of low-resource and developing countries struggle with, is that they don't have a great infrastructure for training health professionals. And when you don't have a good, skilled healthcare workforce, it doesn't matter if a person wants to access good services, they can't. The services are just not available. And so that's something that really is being focused on in a lot of places, is how to scale up the healthcare workforce and make sure that the training is of high quality so that essential services can be provided to all women.
You mentioned you were a Peace Corps worker at one point, and I would think one of the problems of getting enough healthcare workers into some areas is if it's a war-torn, dangerous area, you're going to have trouble getting enough people there that are safe and able to do the kind of medical care they need to do.
Absolutely. There's a lot of places where people are, you know, exiled from their homelands that are refugees or internally displaced people where they weren't actually able to flee their country but are certainly not at home. They're in large camps within their own countries and have been internally displaced. And healthcare services for those populations is very difficult. Doctors Without Borders tries to get in and provide services, but it's often not enough to meet the needs of the people, and it's very hard to access those populations. And then if you look at other things like infrastructure such as roads and transportation and vehicles, if you don't have an adequate infrastructure of roads, it's really difficult for women in remote or rural areas to get the care that they need. So that's another thing that needs to be looked at, is not just the healthcare side, but the infrastructure of the country itself and how people can move around and access the services.
You might mention some of the work you're doing directly, Cynthia, with the group that you're working with, and you're trying to improve the residency program. And
well, you know, we have we've started a partnership. It's still in its early phase with a university in southern Ethiopia. There's a city called Hawassa University, and they recently launched an OBGYN residency program. So we're helping try to support the training of some of those residents and also build a little bit of research infrastructure to collaborate with the faculty there. And, you know, it's been great for us as well.
As well as for them.
Absolutely.
Sure.
She's doing a wonderful job.
That's great. And what are some of the other global health issues for women that stand out to you as most in need of being addressed? I mean, I've heard, for example, about the high rates of AIDS, sexually transmitted disease.
Yeah.
Certainly women dying in domestic abuse situations, which I know isn't exactly medical, but it certainly can, lead to death all over the world.
Yeah. Human trafficking also is something that's really been looked at more closely because women and young girls are much more likely to be forced into labor and, illegal sex trade. And that really has a huge impact on health and well-being, too.
The AIDS is, it's really, there are ways to treat it, but the people, even in the U.S., I mean, the number that are infected, and they don't realize it. And so they're not getting therapy. And I think trying to get that globally, it's also very important because people are still dying of it, and it can be treated. And so I think that that is also an issue, I think, not only globally, it's as a matter of fact in USA.
Well, in the 5 minutes or so that we have remaining, can we talk about, we've been talking about a lot of sort of bad statistics and sort of scary things and things going wrong, but why don't we talk about some things that could be done? Like if you had the ears of all the women out there and you could tell them, here are some things you can do in terms of being an advocate for your own health care so that you don't get dismissed, or in terms of taking precautions, or what are the most important things that you think women should be hearing right now that they might not be?
Well, I think one of the most important things you can do to improve the lives of girls and women is to provide access to quality family planning services. We know that, young women and girls who have unplanned pregnancies are in harm's way, and, pregnancy can be a really joyous experience, but it can also be a life-threatening time when there are thousands of women who die every year. And so we want to make sure that, women have access to the quality contraceptive services and family planning services that they need. So I think, knowing that family planning promotes educational attainment, it promotes, career aspirations and better economic attainment for women, and it promotes the stability of families and social and economic development within families and within communities. That's something that I think, we just need to carry that word far and wide.
I think what I would like to see is that women have an opportunity to get all the preventive agents things that we have. I think that breast cancer, you know, we have the guidelines for mammograms.
Which they keep changing.
Yes,
which they keep changing. And not only that, I am a little concerned because African-American women get breast cancer at a younger age. And so they say, okay, it's automatic at 45. And if you have some concerns, it should be 40. Well, it might have to be younger than that because they do get breast cancer very early and it's very aggressive. And so I think that if we can do that, if we can get HPV, the vaccine that we can have to prevent cervical cancer, if we could just get everyone to get some of these prevention availabilities that we have, that I think that that would be a big thing, a positive thing from my perspective, and also do whatever we can to close the gaps and health disparities. That's what I'd like to see happen.
With the HPV vaccine in particular, there was controversy for some people around that. Can you talk about that in particular, why it was maybe not something that everyone thought should be done?
Well, they thought it shouldn't be done because if you have HPV and you don't have to worry about having cancer or something, you're more apt to be sexually active. And I think that was an issue that is got it's gone now. But it's and we have to get, even now, get the pediatricians involved and see what we can do to get that taken care of. But you're right, there was an issue with that, and people were concerned about that.
So these are things that women could do sort of as patients and certainly speaking up for themselves. What about if you had the ears of all physicians? What would you want them from that end to maybe think differently about or do differently about with their patients?
Well, I'd like to have the ears of everybody. And because as we talked about the social determinants, I mean, it's really, we have to all be thinking about it all the time. And I think sometimes we aren't. And so, you know, if we can get if physicians, you know, they're busy taking care of the patient, so sometimes they don't have that other time to get them into where they have to go to do this or to do that. And so I think if we could have people even helping with that.
You mean looking at the wraparound services,
yes,
the life problems of any patient?
And I think that that would be helpful. And I think that, I think we need to have the eyes and ears of everybody to really address this issue.
Yeah, the American College of OBGYN also just came out with a position statement about the huge impact that global climate change is having on the health of women. And it's pretty clear that it's widening the disparity gap. So if you have you know, less access to healthy, clean water and lower access to a stable food supply, roads that might be washed out due to flooding, you end up disproportionately impacting women and the lives of women and children. And so we also have to really keep an eye on global climate change and be thinking all together as a healthcare community, but also collaborating with everybody and anybody to do what we can to slow or reverse the impact of climate change.
Lots to do.
Lots to do.
I'll have to have you both back in some years and see how we're doing on that. Thank you for being my guests this hour. I've learned a lot. My guests have been Gloria Sarto and Cynthia Anderson, both doctors in the OBGYN area within the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year.